Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. The Eco Leadership Institute is about to launch our new Diploma in Leadership Coaching. This comes in two parts. We have depth approaches to leadership coaching and systems approaches to leadership coaching. These are two certificates, and if you take them both, you receive our diploma. The depth approaches will include some of our Lacanian psychoanalysis. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, please get in touch with us, and we look forward to hearing from you. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today we have a special guest, Kate Mosier. Kate is Global Director of Pledge for Change, an organization focused on delivering radical change in the humanitarian sector. Previously, Kate has spent over two decades working in humanitarian contexts, most recently as Regional Vice President for the Great Lakes and Central Africa, working for International Rescue. Kate's held a variety of leadership roles with Save the Children in South Sudan, DRC, and Côte d'Ivoire, having begun her humanitarian work in protection services with refugees and asylum-seeking children in the United Kingdom. Kate holds an MA in Applied Linguistics and an MSc in Global Development Management, and recently completed our diploma in Eco Leadership Coaching, and she's very keen to put the principles of eco leadership into practice with the Pledge community. Kate is a feminist who believes it is possible and necessary to transform the humanitarian sector so that it is congruent with its stated values, and she's excited about working on disrupting power dynamics to distribute an aid ecosystem based on the principles of equity, solidarity, and self-determination. Kate's a solo mother with a wonderful 8-year-old, and she loves walking and cycling in Nairobi's forests with her son and their dog. Kate, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be here. I'm good, thanks.
Good. We actually, just for the audience's knowledge, we started this conversation over a week ago, and it was interrupted because there were some riots in Nairobi, and the government shut down the internet. So let's hope there's no riots today, Kate.
I must, on behalf of Gen Zs across Kenya, correct you for the use of the terminology of riots. They were peaceful protests that were disrupted more by the forces of law and disorder, I think, is the dominant discourse over here. It's a contested space.
Apologies to Gen Z, but they were successful as well, up to a point. The government backed down on some of its major principles. Is that right?
Yeah, the initial complaint was about the finance bill, which the government were trying to pass. That was 2 weeks ago now, and that was where the original protest came from. It's all evolving quite rapidly, and it's unclear to me where it's gonna end up. But it's been really interesting and really quite inspiring about how large social mobilization is possible. And as I say, these protests were very peaceful. There was an extraordinary vigil this Sunday that was not policed really to any extent, and as a consequence was very, very positive, peaceful, and felt like a really good space for people to come together, both to grieve some of the damage that had happened and the loss of life that had occurred, but also to look forward to what they're trying to change together for the country.
Yeah, and I heard the president on Twitter on a live stream with a young audience challenging him. It's very interesting to hear, new social media being used in political ways. Really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah, 3-hour X spaces that now, anytime you walk down the road, people are all on. Everyone's got their headphones plugged into the latest X space, and some of them are coming from the kind of the radical protests. Some of them are coming from inside government. It's a really interesting time.
Yeah. Let's see how it unfolds. Mm-hmm. So, Kate, you're in this work. You've been in it for a while. What brought you into the humanitarian sector in the first place?
The truth is my arrival in the humanitarian sector was largely accidental, coincidental. I grew up in a family where there was a strong sense of social justice. I remember my teddy bear being sent off to the miners during the miner strike, and that feeling quite tricky at that time. So I think there was an expectation in my family that I have two sisters, they're both social workers. So there was a definite kind of lean within family. But I graduated with languages, went off and traveled, didn't really know what I was going to do. Still don't really know what I'm going to be when I grow up. Came back to the UK after a number of years abroad, and got a job quite coincidentally in an international development organization, a very small one, that gave me an opportunity to kind of see and learn across lots of different functions. And then realized that I was missing the very kind of frontline direct work, that I'd been doing in schools with young people in Japan. So I went to work for Save the Children, in the England program, working with young, refugees and asylum seekers, and Save put me and about 30 of my peers, we were the first cohort of the Emergency Operations Program, which is the precursor of the, Humanitarian Leadership Academy that you're very familiar with. And as a consequence of doing that, course, I then got a job out in South Sudan, and that kind of set me on the way to today, I suppose.
Yeah, and you see a lot on that journey. I mean, you see a lot of humanity in all its different forms. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the first thing to say is just that the sector has evolved enormously since then. I was talking to a colleague about that program that we'd been on, and he was describing me and my peers as the last of the Salvationists coming out of that program. But we really were, I mean, we were a bunch of white British 20-somethings graduates with a set of skills that the sector felt were missing in some of the country programs. So they sent me off to South Sudan, and I was called the Planning, Learning and Communications Officer. So it was a real kind of mix of a job of things that they couldn't do. And I worked with mostly men, mostly much older South Sudanese and Kenyan men, vastly more experienced than me. And got this real kind of benefit of my identities. My whiteness gave me a lot of advantage in a system in a way that hopefully it doesn't quite as much these days. I found South Sudan really, really challenging, partly because I was so inexperienced. And when I left there after a couple of years, I came back to the UK and said, I'm not going to go back to a fragile state. I felt I was in a fragile state, and that I was not being useful, which was sort of my ambition. And then again, through a kind of default of position and identity, I was asked to go out to DRC, on a short term stint, which I did. And that country, that context, that conflict, that place, those people, something really profoundly connected with me. And I feel like I did a huge amount of learning, of growing up, of unlearning, and of really connecting to, as you say, a sort of sense of living with and in the very best and the very worst of humanity in the same, sometimes in the same sentence, often in the same moment, certainly in the same day, the same week. feeling those real extremes, and sort of always being aware of my absolute privilege and the very kind of safety that again, my whiteness and my position brought to me in the sector, but also of my sort of emerging at that point ability to make a bit of a bridge, make a bit of a connection with experiences of people that was very different from mine, but to be able to help tell those stories and bring attention and support to people in situations of extremists that felt like I found myself in the right place for perhaps the first time.
Yeah. No, it's a very rich experience, and I'm kind of intrigued because a lot of people don't get close to that experience. A lot of people just have they see the news and they see Bob Geldof, or they see, they have an imaginary kind of idea of the white salvationist in as a humanitarian. I've been writing about that recently and just come back from a conference in Budapest talking about that. And as a nurse, when I was a nurse, you're working very closely with kind of death and trauma. You're on the emergency room and you see trauma, there's something about being in touch with the embodied self, I think, which is interesting and missing in many people's experience.
Yeah, I think when you say many people, you're talking about the global north kind of more peaceful context, because of course the experience of most humanitarians, if we want to bring it back to that sector, is these are people whose entire embodied experiences of situations of conflict, of crisis, of the extremes of poverty and exclusion and marginalization in different ways. I am unusual in my friends from Wiltshire and from Bristol, in the places that I've lived, and the experiences that I've had. And I feel extraordinarily fortunate to have been able to visit. And it really, I've lived for 15 years in conflict and post-conflict, environments, but I've always been a visitor, and I've always had a degree of separation from the reality of those conflicts and a degree of a significant degree of comfort and protection as an international worker and as a British passport holder, and again because of my whiteness, but I do believe and hope that it's given me an opportunity to learn, to unlearn, to empathize, to connect with different realities in a way that, feels enormously beneficial to my humanity, I suppose.
No, I'm like, the audience I'm addressing is the audience, I think, listening to this. I got no idea who listens to this. Yeah. I imagine the coaches and consultants who follow kind of our work are often from the global north, Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued as well. In your bio you sent me, you said I am a feminist. One thing I'm interested in and I'm trying to work through myself is there's a lot of talk about decolonizing aid. There's a lot of anger. I'm picking up kind of a real anger, a real kind of movement for change here, and this is what Pledge for Change is partly about. When you say you're a feminist, how does those ideas align to a lot of diverse cultures? How do you think about that? And since I've been interested in universal human rights, for example, are they Western liberal progressive human rights? Are we for LGBTQ communities? How does that kind of play out in your thinking? I'm just really interested to hear your views on that.
Yeah, and those such good questions. I was having a conversation just yesterday about that question of the individual versus the collective, and the way in which that has also, I think, that distinction has been sort of co-opted into a binary of the West and the South, or the North and the South, which is insufficiently nuanced to deal with with people and society and culture, of course. But similarly for me, feminism, my understanding and expression of being a feminist, I think is actually intentionally not replicating some of the Western kind of the white feminism, which has been so heavily critiqued, whereby women of a particular class, race, positionality, education have sought to advance themselves without necessarily thinking about other women, or indeed people of other gender identities or other experiences. So I think the intersectionality is so essential to it. But my understanding of feminism is that it's about understanding and working with power and power imbalances, about believing as a core principle that that equality and sharing of power and resources is the way in which we might advance more successfully as a species, who are all trying to share a planet and a finite amount of resources, but that doing that with kind of insight and awareness to our differences and to the structural and systemic barriers to equality that colonialism has set up, that patriarchy has perpetuated very effectively, that capitalism works hard to kind of push and promote, that neoliberal theory has kept on going. I think for me it's a label of it's a label about believing that humans are equal fundamentally and certainly deserve and require equality of opportunity in order to thrive as a collective. So it's the individual versus the collective. It's both and, I think. We have to be whole humans and fulfilled individuals in order to contribute to thriving communal societies and vice versa.
Yeah. Well said, Kate. We captured it nicely. No, I mean, when I'm working with the humanitarian field, I'm doing this work on ecosystems and mutualism, and like mutualism, could be summed up by what you just said, really, that's the basic ethos of it. You know, you start from that point of kind of like mutual agency, mutual responsibility, kind of mutual value from anything we work with. And that's not to deny power differentials, because they're there, you know, they're very, very clearly there. And but it's how to make them more transparent, how to work with them, and how to kind of strive for more solidarity and more equity, for sure.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, underpins the work for Pledge. Do you want to say something about kind of how Pledge started and your work with Pledge for Change?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. So I joined Adesso, the host of Pledge, just over a year ago, have been helping coordination of this thing just since then. The original idea, the kind of germ of the idea for it, came back in 2020, when Dagan Ali, Mariana McGlasson, and a number of CEOs of the large INGOs came together, really during the period of what is now described as the sector's racial reckoning following the murder of George Floyd, when there was a huge movement following the Black Lives Matter movement, but also inside international organizations, often driven by staff, saying that the kind of tensions and the contradictions in what we're doing and what we say we're doing are becoming, the dissonance is becoming too loud. And so Dagan executive director of Adesso, a thought leader, an activist, who's been working on ways of disrupting the sector for decades. She convened these leaders, and they spent about 18 months in deep reflection. They met for 3 hours a month in facilitated retreats with a number of expert speakers on a process of learning and unlearning about themselves, about their own power, about their own positionality and identities, and the ways in which that those were operating inside these often very, very large federated families of organizations, big bureaucracies that have been built in the aid sector. And they came up with the three pledges, which commit each of the organizations to equitable partnerships. So working with local and national civil society, community-based organizations, women-led organizations, refugee-led organizations, the multiplicity of organizations and associations in the ecosystem in ways that are on the same theme, more alert to power, to how resources are shared, to how decisions are made, to who gets to decide what kind of work is done, and so on. So that's pledge one. Pledge two is around authentic storytelling. So the ways in which narratives are appropriated and shared. As you know, the humanitarian sector, as we've talked about, it originated from a sense of people from some countries going to other countries to offer savior support, to bring in life-saving support. And that narrative is very, very strong still, and is often described as being required for fundraising and for awareness raising in Global North countries and with Global North audiences. And of course, what that does is dehumanize and diminish, the people who are living in the complex situations. So we have a whole pledge around the way in which stories are articulated, and who gets to decide what is told on behalf of whom and whose voices, and so on. And then the third pledge is around influencing wider change. So an assumption in the pledge that these commitments are good things that will move the sector in the right direction and therefore should be changed. We'll see whether that assumption holds. And there is some, I think, some risk of sort of replicating the norms of the system, of assuming we've had a good idea, so we need to tell others to follow our idea and do things in the same way. But yeah, that's the origin. That's the kind of the bones of the thing. I think what we're trying to do to make it different from some of the other similar initiatives is include a really strong piece on accountability and learning, and have designed an accountability and learning mechanism that is intentional about subverting and disrupting norms and power and the way that we often think about accountability, but also hopefully offers a really a safe and brave space for learning how to do things differently and acknowledging that failure is a big part of what we do in this system and this sector, and if we can talk about that a little bit more, we can learn from it more. And that in order to do all of those things, we need the diversity of perspective. We need to not fall into the trap of the binaries and the separation of people, by the different categories that we often impose on them. So to really create this community of people who can disagree quite vehemently and who can be very positional, but with kind of kindness and humility and care, in the hope that gets us to somewhere a bit different.
Yeah. It's exciting work you're doing. And I, you know, the Ecological Institute has been partnering with the HLA, the Humanitarian Leadership Academy, and we're talking with Pleasure Change about how we can kind of collaborate and work in this sphere, because kind of we're very aligned. I'm left with the question of humanitarianism. I mean, I've written about it, and I've been lucky enough to do some research on it and visit different kind of places and people. And I'm wondering if the existing form of humanitarian just has to be dismantled. I mean, you do the research and you find out that 90% of all humanitarians live locally and are from kind of a region. And, you know, the white imaginary is that, you know, we send people over to these poor countries. And, you know, so that gets dismantled immediately. You look at finances and you find out that kind of remittances, people sending money home to their own families and communities, kind of outweigh kind of international aid, like threefold or something. It's quite huge, you know. So like the existing system kind of was founded with Christian idealism. It was a big breakthrough in a way that, as I understand it, that, you know, that we actually for the first time paid attention to the distant other. You know, the suffering distant other actually came into our radar, and people cared, and, you know, and that was a good impulse in a sense. It was like, you know, we can't just ignore the uncivilized other. We have to do something about it. But that sense of salvationism is like so strong in humanitarianism. I come from the outside and I come in and I'm like, wow, it's really striking. And even the rhetoric and people who kind of consciously kind of want to decolonize aid and want to get rid of patriarchy still continue the system. It's interesting, this sort of dilemma, isn't it? Stuck at the heart of it. And I'm wondering whether the whole thing has to come crashing down and something else will emerge in its place, or whether you think a kind of a more reformist kind of agenda will take place.
Oh my gosh, so many interesting things in what you just said. I think, and the first of which, Simon, you and I have talked about this before, that just the risk of falling into the same traps, even as we're discussing this, right? So thinking very carefully about who is the we in the proposition that you've just put forward. Because my experience, you're absolutely right to name, remittances and the non-formal humanitarian sector response. The people practicing humanitarianism don't exist primarily in this system that talks a lot about itself, is very self-referential, and that both of us kind of sit on the edges and sometimes fall into, I think, and are kind of co-opted. So I do feel strongly that the idea of kind of burn it all down or replace the whole thing fails to acknowledge the extraordinary things that happen outside the big S system. And one of the risks and the challenges, you know, the Pledge for Change has been designed very explicitly to work on a particular and actually quite small part of the problem in the INGOs, but a part that is also huge and considers itself to be very important and is doing a lot of reflective kind of process. So the question for me, I think, personally, me, Kate, but also professionally in this role, is how much energy and attention to give to the big S system, to the formal stuff, to the international system, which I think is increasingly proving itself to be so broken. I think there are a few people arguing that it's fit for purpose, and yet it maintains a kind of centrifugal power and a resistance, and the UN being the kind of next layer up of difficult organizations to shift. So my question is, how much energy to give to changing that, or how much to give to nurturing and amplifying and supporting what some people are describing as the emergent system, what you would describe as the leadership at the edges of the system, the people who are outside of the mainstream, who are therefore not constrained by its norms and its incentives, and its rules. Cause that's where I think the really exciting innovative stuff is happening. And I think, you know, I believe that systems persist and exist and persist, because they're doing what they're intended to do. And that the kind of formal international humanitarian system continues to work in what many of us describe as a very dysfunctional way, because that's what it's supposed to do. That's, it's designed to work in that way, and it's supporting some loftier geopolitical ambition that I'm not going to be able to do anything about. But what I can do is connect to, learn from, be inspired by, shout about the incredible work that's happening in DRC and in the West Africa Civil Society Institute and in the Pugioni Center in Indonesia and in all sorts of other places in the system, in the hope that we can learn and kind of shift things as a consequence of that.
Yeah, and I absolutely share that. I mean, my experience of, you know, visiting the Polish NGOs and Ukrainian NGOs and CSOs, and then being in Zimbabwe, being in different countries and seeing people doing some absolutely amazing work, you know, really extraordinary and important work. And we're running an event in Northern Ireland. We're bringing together Northern Irish NGOs and CSOs with Southern Irish NGOs and CSOs, alongside Ukrainian and Polish and Eastern European and Central European people, to learn from each other, share these kind of best experiences, because this for me is where the richness is. This is where the learning is. And, you know, I entered this field with very limited naivety, kind of knowledge of the sector. And in some ways that's useful, because you bring a naive view, but, you know, it really is a learning space, and it's such a rich learning space. I was thinking about that geopolitical work recently, and I think one thing that has happened in the sector, like the international sector, the sector which is problematic. Some people say stuck, some people say broken. But it's actually, it's a sector which I noticed that there's a recent kind of election in Ireland, and one of the posters from one of the kind of more far-right groups said, "Stop humanitarians taking over," or something like this. And it made me think about how in this geopolitical space, the far right really dislike humanitarian UN, kind of like, you know, like Trump will trash it or get rid of it, because they see it as a sort of liberal, progressive, globalist kind of a worldview. And even on the far left, they'll attack it as well. And that wasn't the case many, many years ago. Humanitarians were people who went to a crisis and did something. And it's transformed it into kind of a mega kind of operator, hasn't it, in the kind of global north?
Yeah. I mean, these are big organizations. They're big businesses in many ways. And, you know, clearly humanitarian principles, as originally envisaged, saw the purity of the work as being informed by being able to be neutral and impartial, in situations of conflict. And I think the world has changed so very significantly since those principles were drawn up, and politics has changed. One of the risks about the localization and the decolonization kind of efforts, I think, is that is instrumentalized, and is used in ways that are divisive, and that critique the effort and the intent, which I maintain is the individuals working in these organizations are people who are trying to make a positive contribution to society, to the world, and they work in systems that perpetuate inequality and exclusion, and some are more conscious and resistant to that than others, and some of us enjoy the kind of perks of the benefits of being in a system that can offer very significant rewards, you know, financially and in terms of status, and in terms of being able to tell a story about ourselves as good people, making good contributions. So there's all of those dynamics happening. But I think an awareness of the way in which political discourse can manipulate and instrumentalize and threaten the intent, much in the same way as when we started, you know, still talking about the Gen Zs in Kenya and what's happening with that mobilization. It's important to keep that intelligent focus on what's the context, be that very, very local, national, regional, global context in which we're operating. And how to operate in those, I think, increasingly complex contexts, with a kind of sincerity to these values that we claim, are driving what we do, in ways that we practice those values in the decisions we're making and the ways in which we're acting and being, in the roles. That feels like the kind of sweet spot to me of where we need to be focusing.
Yeah. Is there anything else on your mind you'd like to share with the audience around the kind of work you're doing, which we haven't said? Anything which is, as a Lacanian, we think about lacks and gaps. What are we leaving out, Kate?
What are we leaving out? That's a good question. I mean, I suppose I'm often mindful of the fact that my evolving kind of perspectives on these debates are, well, I believe and hope and work quite actively towards having those perspectives widen. You know, I've made career choices that have moved me from very vertical organizations and roles into something much more horizontal. But I still have my experience and my take on all of this stuff is informed by a Western education, a sense of being able to, you know, home being both this home I have in Nairobi, but also a home in the UK. And so in terms of lack in this conversation, I think it's worth acknowledging that, the experts, on what it means to lead locally, on what decolonizing aid looks like, on what the humanitarian system is really doing, are obviously people other than me. Knowing that, naming that, working with that truth, while also kind of thinking, okay, how do I both hold on to a career, but also to think about the ways in which I can be useful. That feels like that's lacking. That's a conversation that people who look like me often find hard to have. And if we're going to get to redefining a version of global solidarity that is more equitable and practices solidarity and self-determination, we also have to be able to name that piece.
Yeah, that's very valuable. I mean, I do a lot of self-reflection. I go and lie on a psychoanalyst couch every other week, and you know, and I come to this having studied power all my life and things. And you, amongst others, remind me of that. I'm, you know, I keep bumping into my kind of Westernized mindset, my modernity mindset, you know, even though you work very, very hard to sort of decolonize your own mind, that is still there. You're still kind of part of that system, and you carry it with you and will always, actually, like, you know, and it's, you carry it in your skin, in your body, in your social construction of the world. And to have that kind of reflective kind of awareness is really, really important. And like you say, people do find that quite difficult.
Well, because the bumping into it, I mean, I take that as it's almost a visceral bumping into it. And it's when you bump into it, it hurts. You know, it's difficult. That is and yet you can't hope to traverse it without bumping into it. You have to sit with that discomfort. You have to sit with the trouble, as you would say, in order to be able to see beyond it. That does feel really important if there's going to be a meaningful, a true kind of commitment to thinking and working and being different.
Yeah, I'm working with my psychoanalytic lens, which again is a westernized lens, but I think we have ways of just saying things which are kind of said in different cultures in different ways. There's kind of many different ways to understand what unconscious means. But you know, one thing I found is that yes, you bump into it and it can knock your ego, it can damage you a bit, it can make you kind of question yourself. But there's also great pleasure. There's such a great pleasure in solidarity, in communing with people of difference. I mean, for me, it's been one of the greatest pleasures of my life is like, you know, my worst fear is to live in a homogenous all white society and to live in a cosmopolitan or diverse place and have the experiences you've had and I've had many of them is so rich as well. You know, it's like, there's both sides to it, isn't it? There's kind of a pain in kind of seeing your colonial mindset, and there's also the kind of the richness and learning and sharing and collaborating and partnering and all those things as well.
Yeah. And being a whole human, because you can't be a whole human if you don't see more than yourself.
So that takes us on to the last questions. Kate, you've probably listened to my podcast before. I'm going to ask you what from your life, your work, any glimpses of insights into what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
I'm thinking about two things, actually, and I might ask for permission to say both of them. The first connects to what you just said on the kind of the diversity of cultures and the collective, and also thinking about what I'm bringing and on with whom into this conversation. I suppose the concept of Ubuntu, the term, the phrase, the philosophy, that means something like I am because we are, I am because you are. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, we have these ideas of individual versus collective culture and ways of organizing society. And I do think that good societies often exist where the awareness of the I is there, but because of the other and the relational, and Ubuntu is a very, very helpful both shorthand and longhand for that, I think. The other piece that someone said to me recently, a piece of feedback that I got recently that I've been holding tightly because it was such a gift of a piece of feedback. But someone said that they felt that I was able to talk truth to power with kindness. And I think that's a remarkably flattering thing to receive, but also a really good kind of mantra to live in the good life in the good society, like understanding truth and the multiplicity of truths that people experience, and power, but doing so with care and kindness, feels like a way in which we might get through some of these conversations and some of these challenges more together and with some more hope of doing things differently.
Thank you so much. Really, really lovely talking with you.
Thank you.